Welcome to On the Line with the AMA, the official podcast of the American Motorcyclist Association. I'm Alexandra Terhorst. Imagine heading out to your favorite off-road riding area, only to be met at the trailhead with a sign prohibiting motorized vehicles. Our guest today experienced this firsthand and decided to do something about it. In the 1960s, Mona Enos and her husband often took their children off-road riding in the Montana mountains. When controversial legislation was introduced to close trails and restrict motorized vehicle riding opportunities, Mona got involved. Her many decades of grassroots organizing resulted in her induction into the AMA Motorcycle Hall of Fame. Mona's son, Russ, has been a motorcycling rights advocate all his life. Today, he's the chair of the AMA Board of Directors. Fighting to preserve access to public lands is a job that requires long days, nights, and gets little publicity. But when motorcycling is in your blood, the call to act is strong.
I actually got started in advocacy in the early 60s. I was born and raised in a little town up in the mountains, and my folks were all involved in horseback and fishing and hunting in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, and then the addition to the Lincoln Scapegoat Wilderness as I was growing up. There really wasn't any problems about who was going where, and I never thought too much about it at that point. But then when I got married, and I married a guy with a motorcycle, all of a sudden we had some issues that started to develop. And actually, my dad worked for the Forest Service, and so he had a real good memory of where every old trail was all over the country up there. And then he had packed water to the lookouts, and so he knew ways up and down and back and forth. And so he told Dick and his friends, this is how you get here to there. And so they pretty well traveled around and had a lot of really, really good riding. And then along came everybody with trying to make the addition to the wilderness area. And so their first thought was, as they said, well, the main access trails that go into the Bob Marshall need to be non-motorized for safety's sake. And it was like, oh, well, the only thing they didn't realize is there were lots and lots of trails around this one trail that they closed. I think their original thing was they thought they'd closed everything down, and it was soon discovered that there were people watching, and they were like, they were going to catch you going the wrong place. And it kind of was a real hassle up there. And so when they had the hearings and everything here, I tried to get guys that would come, and nobody would go testify. We really didn't have anybody that was really outgoing or knew any, but lots of people that rode. And so we said, well, we'll put a petition. We'll get all this information down that we used all these areas and then get all these people to sign with all their information. And we did, and we gathered all this stuff, and we took it to them and presented it at the hearing, but it was never included in any of the records. I don't know how or why exactly that I ended up hanging in there. I just kept working away and trying to get something going.
I actually got involved in off-road advocacy when I was literally a teenager because I was watching my mom do it at that point. And I actually joke a little bit about, hey, I went to my first meeting with the Forest Service when I was 4 years old because I went with my mom when she was being an advocate, and her and my dad ran a small motorcycle shop and they didn't have babysitters all the time. So I kind of got drug along and was getting indoctrinated whether I knew I was or not.
We had one guy that was really interested in trying to do something for the motorized people and get something off the ground from the Forest Service angle. And actually they said, we don't even know who's there other than we see a tire track where it crosses a creek here and there. So we know you're there, but we don't know where you're going or what's going on. And so we tried to get an organization going, and it ended up, it kind of got started and then just kind of petered out because you couldn't get people to get moving on it. They kept saying, well, you know, the wilderness has got to be wilderness, and that's really great. But in Montana, all of these little areas out here, and they call them the island ranges, there really is no reason that those will ever be wilderness because they've got roads and trails all over them. And so that's where you guys need to go and ride. So it's kind of a thing we just kind of by default said, okay, I guess that's what we will do. Well, then you ended up, you got there, and pretty quick here it is. They're wanting to close everything up and make it all non-motorized for this or that.
Motorcycle riding and going to the mountains, that was what we did as a family. We pretty much went every single weekend. We went trail riding, and after the shop closed on Friday night, you loaded up the truck and the kids, and we all went to the mountains. And I didn't know that there was anything else to do other than motorcycle ride. So to me, you know, motorcycle riding was my life. And I sometimes joke that motorcycle riding isn't a matter of life and death, that it's way more important than that. And, you know, at that point, that was really how I felt about it. So as a young guy, as a teenager, I was watching my mom work her tail off and seeing the places that they told us were safe out in the island ranges, seeing those threatened and seeing our riding opportunities diminishing because of a variety of reasons. And I knew that I needed to get involved.
Soon after Mona began advocating for off-road riding, she learned just how big the challenge would be. Rules changed and decision makers got reassigned, but she, and later Russ, got active. They organized riders to become a force for the motorcycle lifestyle.
It seemed like to me that when you finally had some ideas of kind of how to work it within the system, and you thought you might have a little bit of momentum going, that the agencies discovered you knew too much and they changed the rules. And so it started out as, we just want to know you're there. We realize your guys aren't real good at writing letters and big flowery speeches and stuff, but if they're riding there, we just need to know. Well, then all of a sudden, when they all started writing letters, then it was like, well, yeah, but we've got these letters from this attorney and you should read what he wrote. And it's like, hey, wait a minute, the rules got changed on it. And that's one thing that I will say, I think this happened all the way along. When we kind of got some momentum going on a thing, the rules got changed and people changed within the agency so often and so fast, you didn't know who you were dealing with. About the time you had somebody that understood you and you could work with, they were gone.
I'd had the benefit of seeing my mom get involved, and she'd had some success as a young guy. I wanted to get involved. I worked with some other folks, my mom included, and we started the Great Falls Trail Bike Riders in Great Falls, Montana. I think I was 15 at the time, and I was one of the founding members. The next year, I think it was 1986, we got involved in a state association, helped start that, called the Montana Trail Vehicle Riders. And so at a young age, I was involved, really wanted to be able to keep my own riding opportunities available. And it hadn't really occurred to me that it would matter for my kids, but ultimately it did. So through my teenage years, I was involved in clubs and associations statewide. After I got out of school and got a real job and started riding on the weekends and doing things with my soon-to-be wife, it became what we did as a young couple. And then after marriage, it became what me and my wife and our kids did. So yeah, I've been at it for a long time and continue to be. And I think that it's important if you want the motorcycling lifestyle to understand that advocacy is a big part of it.
I didn't really get into the networking thing. I always felt kind of like I was all out here on my own. Everybody was like, oh boy, I'll back you and I'll help. But you had maybe one or two people in other cities around Montana that worked at it and understood kind of a little bit what was going on, but I never really got involved in looking at the bigger picture until Russ got involved with Novak.
And I was kind of the opposite. I really relied heavily on networking through my whole career, even when I didn't realize that I did. And early in my career, I realized that I could work really hard, and if I set a good example, then people would help me out. And that was what really got the local club going, was people would see what you were up to and they wanted to be part of it. And that was what created the momentum, was working together and getting people excited and getting them engaged. What I discovered in later years was, you know, networking is really the key. And it isn't just about clubs and associations. There's a lot of areas where you might have five or six guys that work together, and it's a small network, but that's what it takes to get things done, are these small, sometimes not so small, social networks that either are organized or not that organized.
You heard Mona mention something called NOVAC. She's talking about the National Off-Highway Vehicle Conservation Council, or NOHVCC. At the time, it was a new national network of off-highway vehicle riding advocates that would soon become a major force in the nation's policy arena for responsible motorized access to public lands.
I actually read about a new organization. This had to be in the late 80s or 91, I guess it might have been. I was reading Dirt Bike Magazine, and there was just a little blip talking about how there's a new effort for OHV, and at that time it was motorcycle folks, to get organized, and this organization is starting, and they're looking for state partners to become involved and start this national network of off-highway vehicle enthusiasts that were looking to succeed and promote great places to ride. So it really intrigued me. So I contacted the organization. And at that point, American Honda was really the company that stepped up and was funding the organization and providing the facilitation. And I was excited to hear about it. And then I was kind of let down because there was already a Montana partner. I was kind of disappointed because I really wanted to be part of that and move things forward for the state of Montana.
At that point in time, I was burnt out and I had just about had it. I was like, I don't think there's anything I can ever do. And Novak put on a workshop and we had a grant.
Yeah.
That we got through the state to send four or five people from Montana down to that. And they went through their advocacy thing and all the things that are going on and actually revitalized a couple of us. And one guy who actually became very, very active and kind of even changed a lot of his ideas because he was one that always thought that when you went riding motorcycles, a woman had no business there. That was their thing and their time. And he was almost like anti-family on it. And I was like, what? This is not right. Because, of course, everybody rode. You just did.
I was contacted by NOHVCC a year or so down the road. And they said, hey, the guy that had stepped up to be the partner just hasn't been participating. So are you interested? And, of course, I jumped at that chance. And the nice thing about NOHVCC at the time was they would pay the partners travel and lodging to get to the conferences, which were at that point twice a year. So I went to my first conference in Atlanta, Georgia, and I think it was 1992, and met a lot of incredible people from all over the United States, just phenomenal people, and learned a lot about what was going on in other places. And the beautiful part about meeting people from other places was that you learned that, you know, hey, you thought you were the Lone Ranger and you were the only one facing the problems and you were having to come up with solutions on your own. And for me, it was meeting people like folks from Idaho or the people from Colorado or Michigan, where they had really highly successful, really well-organized state programs. And so they had the same issues, but they just had a head start on us and had gotten organized. And for me, I realized, hey, I didn't have to reinvent the wheel. I just had to steal the ideas from other people who were way more than willing to share.
Russ's role at the NOHVCC grew. Not only did he employ networking at a national level, he also helped others become successful advocates.
So I stayed engaged with NOHVCC, and in fact, from 1992 until the end of my tenure as executive director in 2017, I had gone to 34 consecutive conferences. I never did miss a conference in that time period. I was just extremely enthusiastic about what they were trying to accomplish. And within a couple of years, I was on their board. Within 2 or 3 years of that, there was an opportunity to join the staff. And I worked on their staff for about a year at that point. I think it was 1998. I actually had the opportunity to step up to the job of executive director. I did that for 19 and a half years. And I'm really proud of the work that we achieved there, of course, in partnership with the AMA. AMA has been a part of the picture since day one with NOHVCC and continues to be. So that makes me really proud that we were able to do some great things. I had an opportunity this morning to really think about what were the big wins. And the truth of it is, in my entire off-highway vehicle career, there haven't been a lot of really big wins. If you get into advocacy and you're counting on big wins to keep you going, you're probably going to be disappointed. But what you really have to understand is that you make progress and you build relationships and you build trust and you become part of the process. You learn the system. And as my mom had mentioned earlier, you know, hey, in the early days of her advocacy career, it seemed like the goalpost kept moving because the agency folks were making the rules. And what they understood was you didn't know the rule. They could kind of change the rules or explain what they needed to as they went and maybe not give you the whole story. So in my career, it became really apparent to me that as advocates, we need to know the rules better than the agency people do. And that means learning about NEPA when it comes to working on public lands, BLM, Forest Service, any federally owned land, learning about your state's environmental policy rules and understanding those rules better than the other managers, better than the land managers do. And being able to play the game honestly, fairly, and by the rule and understand what parameters you can work within. And if you do that, big wins are pretty rare, but progress, you have to look back a ways. But if you do that, if you step back and look and see where you were 15 years ago or 10 years ago or 3 weeks ago, if you're brand new at it, you will see that you're moving forward.
Volunteers are the lifeblood of every successful grassroots organization. Developing a strong volunteer core is essential, and there are crucial volunteer roles that keep an organization running.
We've had some really great help through the years at the local level. We've had a really engaged core, and I think that that's what you're going to find with off-highway vehicle riders is as much as we'd love to have 500 people in Great Falls that are all really engaged in advocacy, you might get 500 people to join a club or become members of a social media group, but you're still going to have the core, the 10% that show up. One of the things that was incredibly valuable that I learned at NOHVCC was about volunteer development. I've discovered over the years that if you've got a lot of work to do, if you ask your members or your friends, hey, do you mind doing this for me? Is there a way you could help me out with a certain job? They'll almost always say yes. And, you know, when it comes to volunteers, it's not about waiting for them to step up. Most of the time, it's just about asking them to do it. And they value being part of the process, but you do have to ask them. And if you ask, they will engage.
I've ended up taking care of grants and the financial end of things for so long. They kind of make it a joke that when you're secretary treasurer, that's a lifetime position with these groups. I think we desperately need to have somebody learn how to do this and to make the connections, because right now with our state and our local group both, we've got lots of grants and we spend bunches of money on that agency grounds, and it really makes a difference in the trails, and it makes a difference how the agencies look at you because you know you're with something in your pocket to help them out.
One of the things that I think is really important about advocacy that almost universally gets overlooked is when it comes to being a really effective club and utilizing grant money and just doing the basic operation, you know, there's lots of us folks that are more than willing to throw a chainsaw on our motorcycle and go up and cut logs out of the trail because, you know, hey, we got to do that to ride or do the physical stuff or, you know, spray weeds, you name it. Those are the things that are easy to do. The things that are hard to do and keep a club viable is the administrative side of things. Things that aren't quite so glamorous, like filing a report for a grant or doing the taxes or doing the federal forms that need to be filed each year. That stuff isn't glamorous, but without that, to be really well organized, you can't really get there without that skill. So if you have someone who's doing your administrative stuff, you need to really appreciate them and thank them for doing it. In the case here in Montana, we're looking for ways to replace the skill set Mona has because she mentioned she retired. She's retired several times, but we just won't let her quit.
In the world of motorized off-highway vehicles, there are motorcycles, all-terrain vehicles, often called ATVs, and now side-by-sides. How well do these riders all get along?
One of the things I think that we also have now is with the advent of side-by-sides, we have got a lot of people that are involved in OHV use with a side-by-side that do not have the background that came with having started out riding a motorcycle or even an ATV. Those people don't have any idea of what's coming up or what could be. I think they have a side-by-side and they can just go and it's all there.
It was kind of a hard sell to get the motorcycle enthusiasts to allow ATVs to join our club. But as our club members have aged and motorcycling becomes more difficult, you know, Montana has some pretty extreme terrain and it's big country and it's rough country and it's not necessarily easy to ride a bike on. A lot of our members started to ride ATVs because of aging or other reasons that they felt more comfortable. And as the technology has moved forward, now we're seeing more and more side-by-side use. And that isn't without controversy. Probably the biggest issue that we're facing locally right now when it comes to side-by-side use is 50-inch trail use. Virtually every manufacturer now offers a 50-inch wide side-by-side unit. And we need people to understand that the choice of where you ride needs to be made before you purchase the side-by-side. You make your decision as an informed consumer. And if you bought a 60-inch vehicle, you should understand that there are limitations and that you're only going to get to use trails over 50-inch and agency roads. So big deal right now. And we're working on educating the public and working with the agencies to solve some of those local issues. And it's not just local. It's public lands everywhere. That is kind of the next motorized issue that we are hoping to address.
Just as the motorized crowd gets its act together, a whole new breed of machine is appearing on public trails. Electric motorcycles and e-mountain bikes. Traditional-looking bicycles with electric motor assist. Where do they factor into the mix?
We're already seeing the lines blurred between mountain biking, pedal assist, and full-on e-motos. Now some of the pedal assist units, the horsepower and the performance is just staggering, and the range, it's amazing. And that technology is going to draw hundreds of thousands of people from the bicycle community towards e-bike and from the motorcycle community towards e-bikes and e-motos. So there's going to be a lot of challenges. To my knowledge, Forest Service units consider all e-bikes, whether they're pedal assist or throttle control, as motorized. Some of the municipalities have addressed stuff like wattage limits, speed limits, things like that to try to get a handle on it. But yeah, it's going to be both an opportunity and a challenge for agencies, for riders, for organizations. It's going to be a big deal in the next few years.
With all these new kinds of vehicles, and with the rapid changes in how people communicate, will off-road riders of the future carry on the good work started decades ago by motorcyclists like Mona and Russ?
One of the frustrations that I run into these days that's, I think, not uncommon for people who've been at this advocacy game for a while is that we've got some really cool, well-managed riding areas with easy-to-follow maps and pretty well-signed. And there's a lot of younger riders getting into the sport. They'll show up at the trailhead and they have a nice map in their hand and they unload their bike and they look at the sign on the ground and the new vault toilet at the trailhead and the great map and say, isn't it great that the Forest Service provides all this for us? But what they don't understand is that there's literally 40 years of advocacy with the Great Falls Trail Bike Riders, with Mona, myself, other local folks, working our tails off to get us to the point where we're at. And of course, we can't do it without the agencies. But the truth is the agencies, there's great people in the agencies, but they have a lot to do and they're not necessarily motivated to do everything for everybody. So we have to push them. We have to advocate for ourselves. We have to make all those great, cool things happen. And now we're at the point where we can look back because we've been in it for decades and say, man, we look at what we have now, and some of it's really cool. And the frustrating part is some of the younger riders, most of the younger riders who aren't involved in clubs and associations really don't understand what it took to get to where we're at. And one of my concerns is they really don't understand what it's going to take to maintain it. One of the challenges for the future for us as advocates is figuring out all the young people that are getting involved in riding, how do we reach them? It's not the conventional ways that those of us who have seen a few decades think about. It's not meetings on every other Tuesday. Now it's social media and reaching out through other channels that we're not used to as advocates. So, I think that's the next big challenge for us is how do we pass on what we've learned and what we've built and make sure that it's in capable hands.
If there's something going on and we need to have our members contact their legislator, we can email them with the directions, and this is all you have to do is you can call this number or you email them on this and say, yes, support such and such, or no, don't support it.
That's primarily been done through email, and social media is a good way to reach out to people. But one of the things that we have to be careful with social media is thinking that that's the only avenue when it comes to getting people to write letters or go to meetings and those kinds of active things. So as much as I just talked about how important social media is, we also still have to do things like reaching out with in-person meetings when there's a local travel plan that people need to understand, and you need to have handwritten comments. You still need to do all those things. So we can't just make the shift and rely completely on email and social media. It's really about utilizing all the tools that you have at your disposal and understanding the right time to use the right tool.
Advocacy is a critical component of the future of motorcycling. In 2019 alone, the AMA sent over 37,500 emails to elected officials and regulators. So what advice would Russ give motorcycling advocates who want to get involved?
If I were to give an advocate one piece of advice is take your time, pace yourself. It's a long game. You have to have a thick skin and a short memory. You're going to find out a few things. Number one, the world is full of opinions, and we're just one of those. So we have to figure out how to advocate for our point of view in a professional, effective manner and articulate that. But we also have to be willing to listen. You have to be able to take a beating and keep coming back. And the fact that Mona and I have both been doing this for a number of decades, I guess, shows that we have short memories and thick skins, or we would have given up quite a few years ago. The American Motorcyclists Association is really the only national membership organization for motorcyclists and has done an amazing job over the years of creating and inspiring advocates. And if you're not an AMA member and you're listening to this podcast, I sure hope that you take the time to sign up and become an AMA member. It's more important than you could imagine.
In 2009, along with some of the best-known names in motorcycling, Mona Enos was inducted into the AMA Motorcycle Hall of Fame for her lifetime of advocacy.
I just could not believe it. And the thing was, though, that I've always felt it was just totally amazing that when I got down there and I'm thinking, oh, look at these guys that are all, they're famous and they're this and they're that, and I'm getting inducted the same time as they are. And when you talk to them, they said, oh, man, isn't this something? Look at them. They're really famous. And I'm, you know, I just did my job. And I thought, oh, that's what it was. We're just a bunch of people who actually got busy and did our job. So I was, it still just blows me away. And all of the people that I know from all across the country, and they go through the museum, they all go take a picture with my bike and me. And they say, here I am. We're at the museum. So it's just awesome.
I'm not in the AMA Hall of Fame, but it's interesting how many people think I am, because I've gone to a number of the AMA Hall of Fame induction ceremonies with my mom. And so there's this mistaken thought that somehow I'm in the Hall of Fame, and I'm not. So I live vicariously through my mom, and it's been a lot of fun hanging around with a Hall of Famer. And as Mona mentioned, you know, a lot of the race folks are actually very appreciative and, you know, they're pretty excited that advocates are in the Hall of Fame, and it's nice to see that enthusiasm.
Our thanks to Hall of Famer Mona Enos and AMA Board Chair Russ Enos. Read more about Mona at motorcyclemuseum.org. And if you're wondering how long Mona can keep up her advocacy work...
I'm getting older, see, yeah. So I've got to get out of that.
Yeah, I'm a young 80. I'm going to be 81 in a month or so. And I tell her that she doesn't have to worry that we're going to find somebody within the next 30 years to replace her. And yeah. I'm sure we will.
On the Line with the AMA is a production of the American Motorcyclist Association. Since 1924, the AMA has been promoting the motorcycle lifestyle and protecting the future of motorcycling. Learn more at AmericanMotorcyclist.com.